BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
One of the great joys about the Classic Scottish Albums podcast is that we have that space and scope to share slightly longer versions of the interviews we do. The episode on the Trashcan Sinatras featured contributions from three of the core members of the band, John Douglas, Paul Livingston and Frank Reader. And these were drawn from extended conversations I had with them either in person or down a transatlantic line. So, producer Elizabeth Clark suggested we just cut them back to back. First John, then Paul, and finally Frank. So you can have a real deep dive into this amazing weightlifting album. Get the kettle on, get your feet up. This is great stuff from a truly unique Scottish collective. Obviously, let's do the kind of the scene setting stuff for a start. And just talk about the sort of journey up to making that record. And some, I mean, we're not going to spend ages talking about difficulties that you've had and all the rest of it, but what, we could maybe touch on it in so far as it kind of informs how you got to weightlifting.
Yes.
So a bit of a problematic period before that, maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would probably shine a bit more light on the lyrical side of things if we went through some of that. I think around about 96, 97, we'd been 10 years on a major label, pretty much a furnace of activity, day in, day out. We kind of lived in each other's pockets for 10 years and on the road, in the studio, rehearsing, writing, just constantly. And it was we loved it. We absolutely adored it. And things came to change and we ended up, the label shifted personalities and personnel and we fell through the cracks. And we had a studio for 10 years in Kilmarnock, our Shabby Road studio, which we'd kind of learned to be a band and learned it all about each other and learned what buttons to push and what ones to avoid. And
metaphorical buttons?
Metaphorical. Right, okay. Metaphorical buttons. Yeah, the other ones are a bit more tough to learn. But no, we learned how to use a studio and make music to the way to our own liking. And that sort of came to an end around about 97, 98. So it was a radical shift for us. For 10 years, we'd been together day in, day out, working on this stuff that we loved. And then suddenly that was all taken away from us. No label, no studio. And we just drifted for a while. And the wind, we had a few little spots through that of positivity. Our Japanese publishers came across and were sort of proactive in getting us to do something. So we ended up taking a little trip to Japan and made a record over there with a Japanese band and did a few shows, and that was good for morale. We had to go ourselves, we raised some money and went to the States to try and do a record in a place called Hartford in Connecticut. And we got advised to go there by, again, some friends in the business. And that was good. We did have a nice time there, but it was all a bit, the end result when we came home and we listened to it was a bit dark, a bit dour, and it just wasn't the kind of thing we wanted to put out after a gap. So we left it and we just drifted, as I say, wrote songs. I mean, that's for 40, really, to be honest. That's the way, since the day we met and liked what we all did, that's kind of what we focused on. We ran into trouble after that, promoting songs and all that side of stuff was always a bit, like, tough. You know, you had to learn as you go, whereas songwriting was just easy and natural. So all through this dark period, we'd written a lot of songs. And as I say, we're kind of drifting. And one of the key figures that helped us get out of this was a guy called Robin Morton, a manager who I think in the past had managed the Bathers. And he heard about us and offered his services. And we sort of grabbed that with open arms because it seemed like he came across very honest and very positive guy. And that helped us get back on the road. And he pointed us towards, you know, making a record, helping out with the finance and all that. And that's when the light began to shine for us again and we realised we could make a record and went to Duncan's in Riverside and we heard these songs and suddenly everything just sounded positive and beautiful. And I suppose those songs had been around for a while, we'd been rehearsing them for a while, so it was no real surprise that when we went to a studio we'd get it together, you know.
That's interesting though, because there is such a kind of positive thing about the record.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, there's also that. There's also the other side of it, and we'll get into the individual tracks a wee bit.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that you had them around, and you had you played some of those songs live?
Yes. Some of them are from like way back in 96, 97. They started to brew. I mean, there wasn't a lot of live activity, to be honest. We'd have the odd pockets of shows, but we did try and play some of those songs live. But as I say, there wasn't a lot of touring. It was mostly just rehearsal rooms or bedrooms or living rooms and bashing through them until they began to gel. And, you know, it had some journeys. You know, some of the songs were recorded in two or three different versions. I could play versions that have got totally different verses, different melodies, different ideas. But time does its thing, and you eventually think, oh, that's not really working there, and you go back to it, or someone will raise their head in the band and say, that's not as good as it could be. You know, the chorus or whatever is aiming for something that's hitting it, and everything else is just sort of not really getting there. Which is one of the bruising things about being in a sort of bunch of people writing songs. It can be quite bruising at times, but it's also very healthy in a way, because you know, things like that can happen where you'll do something and you'll love some of it and you'll love all of it, and someone will say, no, half of that's great and half of it's mediocre. Get it together. And that's tough to do on your own, you know.
It is. But, and again, that cuts to another big thing for me, and having been a sort of fan of the band for years and kind of looking in and sort of knowing how bands work, I've never been quite clear about what the collaborative practice. It almost feels like this kind of thing that just comes together, gels in your music. But what are the component parts of how you guys collaborate? Is it all co-written? Is it sculpted in the rehearsal? Just put me in the room with you when you're getting a song together.
Well, there's a few different ways. It's all collaborative, 100%. But there'll be occasions where someone will come in with, say, 90% of a song, and someone will add that 10%, or someone will take away 20%. And somebody else will come up with the other 30%. And that's generally it. It's difficult to do. If you took individual songs, I could take you through precisely how things went. But just from day one, it's how we worked. When we started out, none of us could really write songs. So I would come in with a chord change or a riff or a line. Or Frank would come in with a line or a chord change or a riff, or Paul would. And eventually someone would take the reins of that and go and sit away in the room and finish it. And that's just generally how it kind of always works. It is a mystery. You know, we don't really go on about it too much because it's quite precious to us. But yeah, it works for us, and that's all I can say. You know,
I'll take you up on that, and we'll go for a specific song.
Okay.
It's one of the first ones on my list. I like every track on the record, right? But All the Dark Horses is one that always comes up. A lot of people love that song, and for me, there seems to be an awful lot of it's like real trash can redux in a way. There's a lot of your ideas kind of flowering in that song.
Yeah,
talk me through it.
That was Paul came up with the initial basis, initial inspiration for that, which was the verses, basically not lyrically so much, but the idea of the three part harmony. And the chord changes in the melody itself. He had that for a while. If where he got it from, you'd have to ask him, but I think he just came up with it, as you do, you know. When you're focused on things just arrive. So he came up with these verses. And then I don't even think there was words for a while. There may have been the odd phrase that appeared. But once he comes up with something, same as any of us do, that comes up with something that's chunky, we give it to everybody else. And at some point in that, both myself and Frank came up with some lyrical ideas. It just seemed such a positive tune. And at one point, I remember I sat in a room and I came up with a different bit that I could add to it, the chorus stuff. Paul eventually came up with the key change stuff at the end. And between, I think, myself and Frank, the lyrics got painted. The main thing with that is, which is very true for all of the songs, is Frank's the singer of the band, 100%. You know, we can rise to the occasion now and again. Some songs will suit some voices, but Frank's the singer, born to be one. So when you're writing lyrics, you know, he's the king of it. He's got to put the tick on it. And, you know, that might sound like a tough thing to do, but to be honest, you know, we're all from the same kind of age group, especially me and Frank, Paul's a little younger, so our tastes are the same. And so there's not really a degree of friction too much. There's always like an acceptance of, oh no, that's great, but that one's no good. Or you say it's no good, right, okay, I'll go away and shift that, because it's obviously no good if you're saying it's no good. So that's kind of generally how that the three of us worked on that way. And again, other times Stephen will come up with an idea for arrangements, or Davey as well. Davey's very good lyrically. When he rejoined the band, it was a great thing for us writing, because they have him back on board. But yeah, lyrically, everything comes from that, goes through that filter of having whoever's having to sing it, has to 100% be able to inhabit it and be it. And because that's the kind of music we love when you know.
You said a thing that really struck home with me there, which was that thing about you or Frank will paint a lyric into it, right? And I totally, that lands with me in terms of your music. And actually, one of the things about All the Dark Horses is the sense in which there is painting, there's lyrical painting, but the musical painting is really vivid.
Yeah.
That section you talked about towards the end with the sort of mandolin guitar where it changes key and it just lifts off the planet, really.
Yeah.
So tell us about that process, and tell us about recording that and how you got that sound and all that kind of stuff.
Well, the major thing about that is the key change itself, which Paul came up with, because he told me he was working with a little cassette 4-track back in the day, whenever it was, 1997, 1998. And on this particular thing, there was a little speed shift button. And he was doing something, playing a song, and then he thought, I have to just do something. He leaned over and he hit the speed thing, and it just shifted a semitone up at that precise place where it does in the song. Suddenly, there was treasure in the room. You know, there you go, there's something brilliant. So he clocked that accident was amazing. And as soon as he played it to us, it was like, well, that's, you know, you can't argue with that. That's class stuff. You know, I can talk about the paints and the brushes, but the actual thing that you're putting on the paint, canvas, is the theme of the song, which is just a kind of optimism through tough times, which a lot of our songs kind of tend to be about. As a unit, we kind of cover all the bipolar stuff. Some of us are pessimists, some of us are optimists, some of us are in between, depending on the day. And I think I was listening to the record today for the first time in God knows how long. And that struck me as there's a lot of that. There's a lot of kind of optimism and pessimism sort of mixed
together. It kind of seesaws, doesn't it, yeah. John? I think that you've got that sort of real sort of euphoric opener, and then just in case we get too sort of happy, give us got carried away.
Yes.
But it's a beautiful thing, and you get the sense that there's, it's not just lyrically, that's one of the important things for me with your music, is it's the whole thing, it's the whole sculpture of it.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that song, Got Carried Away. It's such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's one of my favourites. And that's Paul and Frank, mostly that. I think Paul, musically, Paul came up with the riff and the chords and the vibe. And Frank came up with the lyric, which was very, I think that song's like a cuddle. It's very warm and loving, despite adversity again. And I didn't have a lot to do with the writing of that, to be honest. But lyrically, it was just speaking. Frank was speaking to us, and about the second chances. It's all about second chances, that song. You know, if you love someone or you got a feeling for someone, second chances are priceless. You know, and we went through hard times. We went through a lot of booze and drugs and short sighted stuff. But somehow there's a bond between us where the next day it was, you're all right, and we'll chat about it and get over it. And maybe not chat about it so much, we just get over it. And Frank chatted about it in that song and he hit the nail on the head. You know, that's second chances are priceless, bad days don't really matter.
It's beautiful. Okay, so we'll come back to individual songs, but I wanted to maybe start talking a wee bit about the way that you recorded it. Had a good chat with Duncan Cameron around about this, and it feels like it was a very focused period of creativity in the studio.
Yeah,
tell us how you arrived in Riverside.
I can't. Probably Robin that recommended the place to us, and the personnel. It was close to home at that point. I think we were still all living in Scotland. I think Not sure. Frank might have been in the States at that point. I don't know. But we're very focused because we knew we'd be clock watching. For 10 years with the studio where we didn't need to clock watch. We had a little experience in America where, again, it was a residential thing, so there was no real clock watching. But we knew we'd be on a budget, and we knew we'd had to watch the clock. So that was a major thing of focus. And also we had this experience of trying to do this before, and we'd, you know, been disappointed. So in the interim period, we'd rehearsed and we chose all the songs. By that point, we had them all written. We knew that we had, you know, if we get all this done right, this will be something we're really chuffed with. And there was no sort of question marks about it. The material was good. And Riverside was handy for us. We could all drive there in the morning. It's a bit tough. I remember getting breakfast. There wasn't a lot around. It was focused. And we had our days planned out, our weeks planned out. We'd go home at night, you know, excited and ready to go in and do it all again the next day. At that time when we were recording, we were planning on mixing it and having it all done, ready to go when we finished the sessions. Mixing was the place where it sort of run into a little bit of doubt about how we would do things. We eventually got it sorted, but the recording process was priceless. You know, it was just really easy. The engineers and all that, everything was just great.
Duncan describes a sort of willingness to commit to sonic ideas. You know, we've got so used, and even by that time, I think in recording, we were used to saying we'll do it later, we'll you know, reamp or whatever. Yeah. But he does describe this kind of willingness just to kind of spend the extra time getting it right there.
Absolutely. So,
and is that part of the sort of sonic kind of sculpting process of the Trash Can Sinatra?
Yes, to be honest, it's we're always in a better place when we can hear the sounds coming out of the speakers that are going to be pretty close to what's on the record. Whether it's us just getting our guitar sounds right before we go in, or once you get in, getting the right sort of reverbs or anything. Yeah, we want to hear how it sounds as it goes. It's just very inspiring, you know. To leave things to later, just things get foggy. You know, there's a lot of choice around and that's tough. Limitations are great. And back then, yeah, there wasn't so much of a world of Pro Tools or digitising stuff. It was around, I'm sure, but it wasn't like the overpowering presence it is now. And I think it's, you know, it's good and bad. Everything's good and bad. But I do like the thing of a bunch of people getting together and working within their limitations, getting the sounds they like, and that's how it sounds. I think recently we've done things on Pro Tools, and you can go, you know, you can waste hours just messing around trying to find something.
Tell us about weightlifting. I sometimes wonder if there's a wee bit of a nod to, you know, Jobim's Waters of March?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's a wee bit of that in it, that sort of the way that the bass works against the chord, and it creates that incredible mood, John. I think it's really strong. Talk
to
us about the song.
You're a 10 out of 10 for that, I'd say. One of the things that I would do, no matter what town we're in, it would be go to the library and find the music books. And one of the things I found at some point, probably in Kilmarnock somewhere, was a Hobeam songbook. Bacharach songbooks are great as well. Not so much for learning tunes, but just for getting the palette of chords that's in the Hobeam, and is very different from anything I'd came across, and the changes. And when you're listening to it, it's so subtle and so you know, effortless and smooth, all that music, to realise there's all this complicated, slightly unusual to my ears and to my fingers stuff going on. So I soaked all that, a lot of that stuff up. There's a few songs where those kind of changes happen, which is kind of unusual for us. You know, we like to, you know, the normal chords are kind of generally suffice. But somehow those changes really, really worked. I think it mostly to do with the lyric, to be honest. The lyric, the chorus was us really talking to ourselves, you know, which I think a lot of groups do, but in the hope that, you know, in doing that, that will be a universal thing when you're talking to other people. And at that, as we spoke about earlier, there were some dark times going on, and that chorus arrived maybe about 98, 99. I don't know where the actual thing, there's something in my head says that Paul was in a Chinese restaurant and he got a fortune cookie and he opened it up and it was two lines, and one of the lines was, "You will find a great weightlifting," and he stuck it in a song. The song that he stuck it in originally didn't really work out, but that line was a diamond, so eventually that fitted so well with these chords. In the just the changes, it just felt like, oh God, Well, that's been there forever. And we've just found it. You know, it's really brilliant. It took us a while to get the verses together. We had all the music. The sort of groove had been around for a while. We called it the Fleetwood Mac one. Because it's got dum, ch, dum, dum, which is loads of Fleetwood Mac tunes like that. And it didn't have any lyrics or anything. And then one of the weird things was, when we got it finished and got it mastered, I went down to London to go to a studio to get it transferred somehow. Or I was down in London and I got asked to go to a studio and transfer this from DAT to CD or something. I went in and I was sitting listening to it, and I turned around and Christine McVeigh walked past just as I was doing this song. I should have said to her, but I missed my chance. I was too. My jaw took a while to get off the floor.
It's amazing that you say, I love that. So the song you're talking, it makes me think of All You Need Is Love. You know, John Lennon was actually, I'm pretty sure, talking to himself.
Oh,
all
sure,
all I need is love.
Absolutely.
So you're using that kind of, that sense of what a song can say to create something between four or five people that's going to land with them, with the sure knowledge that it might then land with other people.
Well, you don't, it's not that calculated. It's just a process. You know, you realise if you're writing things which you feel resonate with you, and you feel it resonate with everybody else, then you'll get a song together. And, you know, what happens after that is anyone's guess. I mean, it could easily have been a B-side and nobody heard it, but the fact is it just resonated so well with us, and we took our time getting it specially right. But, and it has become one of our, you know, most beloved things. But I just think it's a sentiment that everybody wishes was true. You know, someday stress will go. To worry about it.
We started talking about Frank as quote the singer in the band, and I mean, obviously he's one of my favourite singers in music. And on that particular track, I think there's something about the quality of the vocal there that just kind of lifts it. Talk to me about Frank as a singer. And
well, Frank as a singer is, you know, from even before he was in, when I first met Frank, it was in a pub in Irvine. And he had a gig. He was playing in a covers. He was playing in a band called the Trashcan Sonatas at the time, but they were a covers band. And he asked me to come and play. And I didn't know the songs they were playing in it. I remember showing up. It was an afternoon gig in the volunteer rooms in Irvine. There was, like, you know, cakes being sold and all that. And there was a band playing. It was them. And I remember side stage him showing me the chords to some Velvet song, Sweet Jane, something like that. And I thought, okay. But as soon as he got on stage and started singing, it was off. This is a proper singer, and we were kind of, you know, that I just wanted to be beside him when he was singing. And then we started to write songs, and, you know, we just became chained to each other, you know, in some sort of beautiful way. But yeah, as a singer, you know, I just think he's peerless. There's not a lot of proper singers around in this world, and he doesn't blow his own trumpet. It's a very hard instrument to play if you're Scottish and working class, is your own trumpet. And we've kind of, you know, we spend years fighting that stuff. But yeah, I think, you know, time and history will judge his voice very well.
I suppose there's a, it's funny you say, you know, the thing about being Scottish, because there's a kind of, there is a self-effacing thing about him as a singer in a way.
Yeah, well, there,
he's not, I mean, selling it big time, but it's just there.
No, for years we would say to ourselves, all of us to a man would say, you know, I'm just doing this stuff. Why should I be doing things like this where somebody's asking me my thoughts? You know, I'm just the same as a plumber or a welder. And for years I thought, that's right. And then my brother put me onto this. There was some Brazilian football manager who'd been sitting talking, and a guy, one of the journalists, has said the same thing to him. How come all these football players are just getting paid all this money? They're just guys doing a job like anybody else. And he says, no. That guy there is doing something intrinsically his special thing. And all those thousands of people are queuing up to see him because they want to see him doing his intrinsically special thing. And that sort of cleared it up for me. It's like, yeah, we're all individuals, and we've got our gifts and our things to do. And Frank's an amazing singer, and we're, you know, songwriters that I love what we do. And that is special, you know.
Tell me about the one of the things I think Duncan was speaking about a little bit earlier on was the contrast in the guitar kind of approach between you and Paul, for example, and there is a kind of textural thing there, and it's all over Weightlifting as an album, really.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, well, both myself and Paul are guitar players from kind of the same era where we picked up guitar in sort of early 80s, which, if you take yourself back there, you remember it wasn't, I think it was anti-rockist was the phrase. There wasn't a lot of bluesy stuff going around. It was all about texture and finger picking and not showing off, you know, but doing something that was did its thing. So we're kind of both for that school where we like to interplay between guitar players. We're all big fans of the Twin Axe Attack bands, you know, your Thin Lizzy's of the world. And I think it's a brilliant thing to go and see a band. There's two guitar players that are just, you know, playing with each other and obviously listening to what they're doing and filling out holes or leaving space where the other person's, you know, doing something. It's not a thing that we've analysed too much, but it's something that we treasure when we listen back to stuff or when we're playing live. There's even when you strip it down to their two acoustic guitars, which we did a lot of the past couple of years, it's almost better, you know, when it's just stripped down to two guitars and a bit of singing. You get to see it naked and, I don't know, just a lot of empathy going on. And, you know, that's our kind of taste. We're very melodic. We love players like John McGeoch and Johnny Marr and, not so much. Paul would say some of the older blues things, he's into that kind of thing. But
it's definitely, it's coming from, I mean, the other group, and you might disagree, but the other group that I often think of in the same world as the Trash Can Sinatras is the Cocteau Twins, simply because of the way that they sculpt sound and texture and tone and all that kind of stuff. Yep. And it's kind of almost, it's almost music about music, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's they're a big, you know, a big hit with us back in the day. Paul and Frank more than me, but I can appreciate the sculpture aspect of it. You know, the sonic thing. It's difficult to analyse that stuff. All I can say is that's what we do. We play the guitars together and we try and sonically make it sound something that just gels into a piece. All for the song. You know, the song's the main thing.
We'll talk about another couple of specific songs and then you can tell me if I've left anything out. One that I think always just puts a big smile on my face is Free Time. And in some ways it sort of feels like classic Trash Can Sinatras, you know? It could almost be from any era of your music.
Yes. Yeah, I'd say so.
Talk to us about that.
That's, again, one of Paul and I think Frank's songs. I don't know if I had much. I might have come up with some of it. I don't know. But that's, again, in the lyric, you hear the optimism and the pessimism sort of vying for attention. Paul came up with that, and I think he was inspired by, him and his mate went camping on Arran and got really wrecked in a tent in Glen Rosa. And I think he came up with the notion of the song from that. And from what I listened to it again today, and it seems to be about the kind of the perils and also the, you know, the joys of free time. You know, what the hell do you do it? We both grew up in sort of unemployed world, which is coming around again, I believe. So there's a lot of free time and we ended up, because we got together and started making music, the free time just disappeared. We wanted to work all the time. And, you know, if you've got families or girlfriends or stuff, that can be problematic. But at the time, it just must have been playing on his mind, the whole notion of free time. Do you know what? If I'd get it, would I do it? And he found a good thing. He went to Arran with his mates and had an experience. But it's that kind of debate. Musically, yeah, it's total trash cans. It could be off of any record. You know, it's very simple chords, very melodic. As soon as it starts, you kind of know where it's going. And it does its thing, short and sweet. And yeah, ticks all the trash can boxes.
But with that being said, I wonder, and again, you might disagree with me, I think for me, one of the things about Weightlifting as an album is it feels... or it felt at the time and still feels to me when I hear it like a kind of move forward. There was something about it that was more fully formed, maybe just as a production or something, but I don't know. But more generally speaking, it really felt like a big move forward. Is that something you're aware of?
Sort of. Like, our first record, production-wise, was a bit of a mishmash. It served us well in the world, brought a lot of limelight our way. Our second record was kind of the only record we made with a producer for the whole period, and it was a very together record sonically. Third record again was a bit of a mishmash of different recording times and different people, and this one was back to just one situation, one studio, and we'll do it all in one go. So I suppose there is a continuity that way. Song-wise, again, it's probably more well-filtered than some of the previous records because we'd spent a long time making it. This wasn't the only bunch of songs we've written in those 10 years. There's quite a lot of songs that maybe eventually came out in other places, but we knew that they, once we filtered it all down, those were 10 solid things that, you know, do what an album should do. It peaks and peaks and troughs pace-wise and mood-wise. It can shift here and there. So we're very sure about, we probably had the running order figured out before we even went in and did it, thinking back on it now. But I don't know, Andy Chase might have had a say in that. But certainly we knew that these songs were the ones that made the grade for the record. So maybe that would contribute to it being like more of a piece.
Yeah, there's a sort of completeness about it. Have I left any songs that, out of our conversation that, you feel are important to talk about? I mean, I like them all.
I don't know. There's a lot of songs in there. There's a few I don't really speak about. There's a couple I could speak about because I was more involved in, I suppose.
Yeah, let's see them.
Usually is one that...
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very quick thing to arrive. It maybe took a little bit for the band to organise it, but that was that kind of served it well. Again, everybody chipping in their ideas. But lyrically, that's... We were staying in Kilmarnock, and I used to go... We all used to go to the charity shops to get our, you know, our clobber. And I went in one day, and there was an old fella serving, which was unusual. Usually it's old ladies, and he kind of smelt of the pub. And he just looked a bit lost. And all the women were fussing over him, making sure he did the job right and put the money in the till and all that. And it just struck me as something odd, because, you know, West Coast of Scotland, guys go first, especially if they're of that older, maybe engineer background. I think it was Billy Connolly said you don't see an old welder. And I just thought it was odd to see that. And it ended up a song that day, and somehow, you know, just a little thing like that can spark a song. Wandering into a charity shop and seeing some old fella that just looked a bit lost. And it ends up in a song, which, again, the years I've been very kind to.
It's got that beautiful guitar intro as well, that lovely kind of ascending.
Well, that's Paul right there. I mean, he's classic at that, just lovely, melodic, but capturing some sort of mood. You know, whether it's the kind of joyous Dark Horses thing or like that, it's like a beautiful little pause for thought. And it happens a few times in the song and really, you know, just really enhances the mood of what it's about. There's another one called Trouble Sleeping, which has got kind of darker terrain than what we normally go on about. Irvine, where we were brought up, there was a young girl got murdered there in the early 90s. Her name is Shona Stevens. It's still unsolved to this day, but it's kind of in the estate. There's a couple of estates on the edge of town, and one of them, Paul and Frank were brought up in, and the other one, me and Stephen were brought up in. And on their estate, this is where this girl got killed. And it was kind of obvious from the facts of it that somebody local must have been the murderer, because it was in a shortcut that only new local people would have known. And when this happened, it kind of horrified me. And then as the years went by and you realised it wasn't getting solved, one day I woke up and I was thinking about it, about the people left behind, the parents, the person in the town who did this is living with it, and the space left by the kind of victim thing. And some poetry arrived just thinking about it and ended up in a song, and Frank chipped in, helped with the melody. And there was some few other people involved in it musically. But it's just a mood that I find very, very unusual. And the subject matter probably isn't the nicest, but, you know, just what a lot of our songwriting comes from, just the thoughts of the day. Whatever the thoughts of the day are and whatever the tune is, marry them together. And no matter how odd it might seem at the time, and that's how it works. Sometimes it doesn't, you know. Sometimes the words that come aren't the right words, and somebody will say, that's a funny one. Where are you going with that? And you go, and you try it, and you push it, and you go, you're right. That was the wrong way you got. Let's go back and start somewhere.
Might find
else.
Another home.
Yes.
You've talked quite a few times about Scottishness And things that do or don't happen in Scotland and between Scottish people and all that. I mean, this classic Scottish albums, do you have any conception of yourself as a Scottish band? Do you have any idea what that means? And if so, where do you think you fit in Scottish music?
It came after a while, it started to sink in that we had an identity that was Scottish. Travelling, you know, a record did very well abroad, and that, you know, that sort of brought it home a little. People would constantly be asking about certain terms of phrase, and you'd realise, oh, that's parochial, is it? Jeez, I didn't know. And over the years, a lot of Scottish bands have been very kind to us and you know, supportive and appreciative of what we've done, which did make us feel good. Because we weren't a Glasgow band or an Edinburgh band, we were from the sticks, you know, the somewhere down the railway line. That's where we are from. So there wasn't any scene or history as such, you know. Whereas the Glasgow band's always quite jealous of that. You know, there's a rich history, which can give you confidence when you're young, knowing that you're not the first to tread the path and the path's kind of there. So to be outside of that was kind of odd. But, you know, people like Justin Curry and James Grant and the Delgados people, some of the Bells, you know, just over the years have been very complimentary. And that made us feel, and Tracy, for the Camera Obscura and all that gang, it just makes you walk a little taller in your shoe. As far as being Scottish and what it means, I don't know. I remember Michael Mara saying to me, oh, you're West Coast, aren't you? And I said, what do you mean? He said, your music's West Coast. And he said, and I said, well, I suppose, right? He says, something about the West and the sunsets gets into the music. And also just the nature of Scotland being at the edge of Europe, you know. Somebody has said it's the end of land sadness. You hear that in the music. And also, you know, there's nothing on the horizon except the sunset. So there's optimism there as well. You know, whether that seeps into anything, I don't know. But certainly in Scottish music, I find there's a lot of sort of melancholy mixed with hope.
I think you just described the trash can.
I'll go up to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful. Thank you so much, John.
Pleasure.
That was John Douglas of the Trash Can Sinatras in conversation with me up at the BBC in Pacific Quay, Glasgow. Next up, I spoke to Paul Livingston down the line from Tacoma, Washington. So one of the things, obviously, we're focusing on weightlifting, and again, not to sort of, you know, labour too much on some of the difficulties that you guys maybe faced in the run up to that record. Nonetheless, I think it would be difficult to talk about weightlifting without talking about some of the problems that you experienced in the years running up to that.
And,
why would that work from your perspective? What was your experience of it?
You know, we had done the first two albums on Go Discs, and we had tons of money kicking around. I was young. I just thought, you know, this is how it is from now on. Great. And then things started to sort of waver after the third album. And then, yeah, Go Discs got sold to Polydor, Polygram. And they were like, who are these guys? They cost a fortune and they don't make any money. So they chucked us off and we lost, you know. Then there was a lot of money trouble for a few years and we ended up going bankrupt and losing our studio, Shabby Road. And so that was a really heavy time, I'm sure you can imagine. But, you know, somehow we played through it. We got a couple of new members, young guys, Stevie Mulhern and Grant Wilson on bass and keys, and we would just jam in Shabby Road for hours. So the thing about making this album after going through all that, I mean, it's good that it's called weightlifting because that is what it felt like. You know, it showed us that we could make a record and it, just the heavy vibe was gone. There was no record company breathing down our neck. You know, there was pressure to have hits. I'm sure you know about that. It's just pressure to do things a different way. And so we didn't have that with this record. And then there was also just the pressure of, oh, we're going to go bankrupt and lose everything. How's that going to work? that was gone and we were through the other side, and it just felt like, oh, we can do this, and we still want to do this, you know, still want to be in a band. And so, yeah, it was a very important album for us. It kept us going. And, you know, when we started making it, there was kind of a feeling of, you know, let's just pick the best songs and record them well and wrap it up, and then that'll be that. And that's as far as we're looking. And so the making of it, and then doing all the tours, we toured a bunch after it, you know, the experience of that was like, hey, this is good. It's fun.
It's funny, it's great you say that about the title of it as well, and because there's a kind of lightness even in some of the songs, Paul, where there is that kind of melancholy, and we'll talk about some individual songs as we go through it, but there is a kind of lightness in this, and there's also a feeling that, I mean, I said it to John just half an hour ago, that there was a big move forward in this record. Certainly for me as a Trash Can Sinatra fan, loving all your records, nonetheless, there's a sense that this moved things forward a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we kind of didn't really know where we were going when we'd done A Happy Pocket. By that point, we were sort of, I think, bored of how we sounded. And so we started experimenting around a bit, you know, after that, where we would just set up in the kitchen in Shabby Road, just like squeezed in there with acoustics and stuff, and just trying different dynamics, trying to get different things going. And, you know, we spent a lot of time just recording songs and messing around, like years. I mean, you know, some of the songs on Weightlifting we'd just done a million times in different ways. And
give me an example. You know, give me an example of one of those, Paul, if you would.
Like, usually was kicking around in Shabby Road, and we played that in the studio with Grant and Stevie for days and days. We would just play these songs a lot. Most of the slow ones we played around about then, there was no Carried Away or Dark Horses at that point. You know, it was like Trouble Sleeping, Country Air, Leave Me Alone. Those ones, things that were really kind of slow, they were older. Somehow, if there was an upbeat song, say like It's a Miracle, you know, playing that round and round somehow wasn't as fun. I think we were just exploring with space and having keys and not trying not to strum.
I know what you mean. And it's funny because one of the other things that we talked about with John, but we were talking about the kind of way that some of the Trash Can Sinatra's music can almost be quite sculptural. Like, it's almost kind of built up from music ideas. Great songs, of course, but there is that sense that you're building up texture and all that in the playing. And that seems to me what you're describing. Would you say that's right?
Yeah. I mean, we sort of ended up playing the way we played back. I mean, we were rubbish when we were first signed. We didn't know how to play in a studio or anything, or we didn't know what we were doing. And, you know, like in those days, you would go into a studio and really the best thing to have is a part, because then, okay, this is what I'm doing in verse, here's the chorus, play the chorus part, just do that. That's easier, because you're going to go in there, and no matter how simple the part, you're going to play it round and round and round, and like for ages, guys getting the sound, doing all of this stuff. It seems weird for me to think about now, but that's how you used to do it. By the time you were recording it and everything was exactly square and hit these strings all at the same level, there was no feeling or soul in it at all. And so by doing that for years, I learned to hate it. You know, I mean, if a riff is part of the song, then that's great. But just putting in superfluous parts just because that sound in a producer's mind should come in here. You know, just like, ah, who cares? So by the time we got to weightlifting, we'd played a lot together as a band in a room. That was sort of the goal of having the keys there. And also the fact that Stevie he's a jammer. He's just like, when he's on fire, everybody in the room's on fire because he's gone for it, you know. Trying to record that, turns out, is actually really difficult. But, you know, it was good to have that sort of jammy aspect. And same with Grant, you know, on the bass. And so there's definitely a lot more jammy sort of stuff going on, and things that we wouldn't have had the guts to do before, like maybe Leave Me Alone or Usually, where it's just, there's a lot of space and it's pretty slow, you know.
I was talking about that beautiful little sort of ascending guitar figure at the start of Usually.
I remember doing that. I remember it used to be better. It was one of these things, we're just rehearsing for hours and just playing it. And I had a multi-effects thing and I sort of pressed the wrong button and it done this sound where it added fifths on top of each note, right? And I was playing that sort of thing and it's sort of in amongst everybody else playing where you couldn't exactly hear what it was doing. It sounded like this sort of choir or just bubbling, blah, 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 and building up and up. And I was like, holy shit, that's amazing. But then when you heard it on its own, it was just this wildly crazy out of tune thing and it didn't work at all. And anyway, if you could hear it, it sounded terrible. But just when everybody was playing loud in the room, it was like, oh my God, it's great. I should have maybe tried to have faked that in another way. But, you know, yeah, it's quite a strange part, but that's how it came about, because it had this other effect on it that ended up not working.
See, the writing process in the Trash Can Sinatra's, Paul, I think it's something I'm, you know, as a writer myself, I'm interested in how that kind of works. And it seems to me there's maybe no one way that you do it in the Trash Cans.
That's right.
So could you maybe talk us through some of the ways that co-writing happens in the band?
Well, like sometimes some of the songs John just came in with and the whole thing pretty much, and then we would, you know, figure out a way to play it as a band, make some changes, whatever. And that would be the same for me and Frank. And then other times it's just, there's a bit that everybody knows about and it's kicking around, and then another bit gets added by somebody else and it spurs it on. I think the best ones are probably done like that, where it's like All the Dark Horses are carried away, where the three of us sort of building it as we went, and, you know, little magical things happen each time it gets passed around, you know.
You talk about All the Dark Horses there, and I mean there's one for me, just the amount of ideas per square inch in that track, it's brimful of them. And I mean the song itself is great, but the you know, there's so much of that detail just kind of lifts it. Maybe talk to us about the writing and the recording of All the Dark Horses.
Well, I mean, it started as just like the guitar solo at the end, the blah, 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 all of that stuff. It started just that. I just had that and I was playing that. It was slow, but that was what was happening. It was kind of wafty and nice. And then I realised that if you sang those three notes, it kind of went in a different thing, different direction. So then at that point, John and Frank got involved and they sort of worked out the singing. And then John added, all it was just this one thing repeated a lot. And then John added the whole bridge chorus thing, which I don't know where that came from. It's not like, here's this, it does this four times. It just was sort of liquid and flowed in a way that just seemed like it was always there instantly. And then once that was there, So it just went verse, chorus, guitar solo. And I was making a, you know, every time it gets passed around, there's a new demo. And I was making a demo on a four track and I was playing it. And I wanted it to be faster, so I just sped up the button. And everything went up a semitone, just when it does on the record. And I was like, holy shit, that's great.
And it's real, what a moment on the track. So you just took that little sort of happy accident and just imported it into the version of the song.
Definitely. That was it. That was made at that point.
It's amazing, and it is exuberant, All the Dark Horses. It's got that kind of foot up in its toes kind of feeling about it. You're talking about the way the band played it. Is that something, that energy, when you went to record the songs, were you able to capture that? Because you're talking earlier about the way that, in a way that production or producing or recording music in a studio can almost, you know, squeeze the life right out of it. But that's not what you hear on weightlifting. What you hear is a quite an excited, engaged band playing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd been in a rehearsal room for a while, and in different places playing these songs, and it was good to get into a studio and just be playing them. But it's hard not to get excited when you're playing All the Dark Horses. Like, the drum beats there, Grant's all over the place, bubbling on the bass, and it's just all systems go from the get-go, you know?
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and it sounds great. Tell us about the experience of recording at Riverside. I know the studio well, and I know the sound of the studio well, and this is maybe one of its best kind of moments, this record, Weightlifting.
Wow. Well, it was great. I mean, it was... Duncan was magic. It was... Everything was just sort of matter of fact. I mean, we weren't under... You know, we weren't experimenting with this record or going with a concept or anything in mind. It was kind of matter-of-fact, like, let's just do these songs. And we had been playing them for a long time, and, you know, all the little bits that happened that were coming up, it's fun to play them, and it was just nice to hear, you know. And Duncan was part of that, you know. It was just instant. It's just like, oh, I'm just getting great sounds. That's Duncan just making it sound great. Okay,
we talked though, Paul, because it's true in modern recording that a lot of the time, you know, musicians will put something down in terms of recording it, and then say, okay, we'll sort the sound later on. But this is a record where you get the sense that all of the stuff was printed to tape the way that it was going to sound.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the arrangements, I think, are pretty... What's the word? Not. I mean, it's obvious what it's going to do. You know, we knew how to play in a two-guitar setup and keep things interesting, you know. So, like, things like Free Time, it's like, okay, that's what it's going to do. It's pretty obvious it's going to do that. Actually, I was thinking about Free Time the other day. There was this guy in Shabby Road, George Butler. He played drums with a 60s beat group from Kilmarnock called The Antiques. And he was in Shabby Road talking about hanging out with Hendrix and stuff like that, you know. And so we had free time at that point, and we thought, oh, let's get George Butler to play on it. He'll play, he's like for the 60s. And it's got that kind of, you know, whiter shade of pale sort of vibe about it. So he played drums on it in Shabby Road. And it was a treat, you know, because people don't play drums like that anymore. It was a very 60s style, you know, like press rolls on the toms. You know, that kind of jazzy sort of way where it's not definite hits, things that wouldn't properly come through on a mic'd up kit these days. But, you know, and just constant fills and just going to the ride cymbal in weird places. I mean, it was great, but it didn't work. It didn't work. We needed something more solid, but that was magic for recording Free Time. I'd like to hear that. I'd like to hear that.
Oh,
again.
I'd like to hear that. I mean, one of the things about free time, though, and again, I think I was saying to you earlier on, Paul, that for me as a listener and as a fan of the band, you know, weightlifting's one that did sort of move things forward. It was a big step for me. But free time is like, could be on any Trash Can Sinatra's record.
Right. Yeah.
It's got that thing. What do you think are those kind of, if you can identify the classic sort of components of the Trash Can's sound or approach?
Busy guitars, not leaving room for the vocal, and then a quiet vocal. that's it. That's the sound right there. I mean, we do tend to have a lot of music going on. You know, there's rarely a lot of space where nothing's happening. You know, I don't know.
No, that's great. I mean, I think that's great, and it's full. As I say, full of, you know, great ideas per square inch. You started talking about the singing then, and so let's, if we could maybe talk about Frank as a singer. It's an important part of the sound, and he's a special vocalist, I think. What is your take on Frank as a singer?
Oh, he's a great singer. He's great. I mean, his voice has changed over the years. He used to shout a lot more, be more aggressive with it, and then he sort of gradually got softer, I guess.
Is that something that happened particularly on the weightlifting songs? Do you think there was a change in that on this record?
There's definitely no. Are there any silly pop songs? I mean, even the sort of pop songs on this are kind of serious, like Free Time. It's got a bit of an edge. It's not silly. All the Dark Horses isn't silly. You know, there's no pop place or just, hey, here's a daft pop song. Or is there anything angry on this record? We don't do anger very much.
I don't think that's really you, is it?
We're not angry.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, John was talking about, you know, one of the songs, giving you a cuddle. Leave me alone, got carried away, and that sense you're talking to each other in a group, and that's a way to sort of come together. So yeah, maybe talk us through that one. It's a beautiful song.
Yeah, that was one where John and Frank for a period just come to my flat in Kilmarnock, and we just gradually pieced that together from a. You know, it started as just a complicated, picky thing I was doing with key changes, a lot of key changes quickly. And then we just sort of took that and turned it into a bigger song over a period of days. And it was a beauty. It was great fun to play. I love playing it. And it's just always sounded really good then. And it always has. I mean, that's one where Frank singing. Yeah, there's a lot on this album where as soon as Frank started singing, I was like, oh, okay, that's great. You know, it's so long ago that it seemed easy with a lot of the songs. A lot of these ones, as soon as they were written, it was like, oh, that's that. That's gone on the album. Just, there's another one, you know. There wasn't very many left out.
It's there's that sort of sense of concentrated good writing, and you know, obviously the songs sound like they sort of chose themselves. Let's talk about the title track, Weightlifting. One of my favourites, if not my favourite on the record, and that lovely, you know, guitar idea that kicks it off. Talk to us about that song.
John wrote that song. What did it do?
So you've got the bass note one tone down from the chord, which is so great.
I mean, John wrote that song, and it is very satisfying on a musical level. And just where that bass note eventually does change for the first time, like after the chorus has started, it's great. It was like, that's brilliant. That's one of those songs where when we play it acoustically, it still works. You don't need to go up at the chorus with all the guitars coming in. You can also go down from the boom, jing, bong, bong, jing, to just the guitars picking. And any sort of change at that point makes it just do something great. We did have another song before that called Weightlifting, a sort of very complicated, long pop song that we spent ages recording in Shabby Road, and trumpets and strings, and we ditched it. But there was a line in the middle eight, and though self-doubt will get to you, you will find a great weight lifting. And that line, John just took that line, put it in his chorus, and it was perfect.
Did it not come from a Chinese fortune cookie or something?
The first weightlifting did, yes. Right, the lyrics came from a fortune, a machine in Brighton that told me my fortune, and it was like the lyrics to this song.
John was talking about the where the song actually Free Time actually came from, and he was talking about your camping trip to Arran. Can you tell us that story?
What's Free Time about? I went camping, with some of my mates to Arran, and just this, walking along just never ending road, and I had some change in my pocket, and it was making a beat, and so then I got this little melody in my head, and I was talking about the rhythm of change, and so that got in there, and then it just sort of went from there. And it was just one of those ones where I'm like, this melody is just too ridiculous. It's too poppy. You know, it's too repetitive or something. But then I got the guitar line, and I thought, putting all of these together, does it even out? Is it cool? And then the chorus seemed to just come along. And then there's a key change in that one as well. I was probably trying to get some of that All the Dark Horses magic. I mean, that was an easy one to do. And it's just about, filling in the space. At that time, for years before, I was just like, all I'm doing here is being in a band. That's all I'm going to do with life. And so everything else, I'm just sort of killing time, and it's just free time to fill with whatever you feel like doing, you know. Especially in those days, you know, just hanging around. There's a lot of hanging around in the trash cans in between albums, just sort of not doing anything. And we're sort of used to that now. It's just like, oh, this is being in the trash cans. You know, people talk about that period where we lost the studio and stuff as our hiatus, and then Weightlifting was our album when we came back. But it just felt the same to me, apart from the stuff that was going on. We were in the band during all of that period, you know?
You do sort of get used to it, don't you?
Yeah.
Wait, one kind of last kind of wrap up question for me. You know, we're calling this a classic Scottish album, which it is. Do you sort of see yourself as a Scottish band? Do you even know what that is? And if so, where do you think the Trash Cans fit in to the world of Scottish music?
I see us as a Scottish band. I mean, there's a lot of those different guitarists from Scotland, and I like a lot of the sounds that Scottish guitarists make. John McGeoch, Big Country, you know, Robin Guthrie, you know, there's those guys I can hear in Trash Cans Records, and Orange Juice, you know, that kind of thing. So a lot of those picky guitar bands, and it does sound a bit like Rain. It's a lot of hi-hats and a lot of picking guitars. It's that sad looking out to the sea when it's raining vibe, you know. That's a Scottish thing, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Funny, I mentioned the Cocteau Twins to John earlier on. For me, that's another group that you know, you sit beside, even just in terms of the kind of aesthetic beauty of it, you know, the just the kind of glitter that comes off the music. It's like almost shining, you know.
That's great.
That's where I'm at with you. I tell you what.
That's lovely. I like that. Thank you.
Paul, I salute you. I love your music. Thank you so much for talking to us.
It's been an absolute pleasure, David. Thank you.
That was Paul Livingston of the Trash Can Sinatras in conversation with me down the line from Tacoma, Washington. I next spoke with vocalist Frank Reeder from his home in Pasadena. I've spoken to John and to Paul tonight already, and I don't think you can really talk about your weightlifting record without sort of acknowledging the sort of difficulties that you had on the way to make that record. And I just, from your perspective, Frank, what are your memories of the lead-up time to that record?
We've done our best to kind of bury it, I think, a wee bit. So, but I do remember, you know, like there was some last days at Shabby Road, our studio that we had through the first three records, that, you know, they got pretty dark, and it took us a wee while to get out of that. We had a kind of bankruptcy, and there was a whole load of, I mean, I don't know if you've ever experienced anything like that, but we were, as you'd imagine, kind of rabbits in the headlights a wee bit, you know. We just didn't know what we'd got ourselves into, really. So yeah, we had we sort of, that period saw the end of us being all together, really, and having some kind of like structure, you know, like a band does when it has a record contract and other people are kind of like, you know, there's a support structure around you. So that kind of left, and we started the kind of plan free years sort of kicked into gear, do you know what I mean? So yeah, so there was a couple of years of us just really figuring out, getting out of that situation was quite a long and laborious thing. But you know, eventually we got out of that and we started to sort of like, where are we, what do we do? And I've got a feeling there was a kind of something in the air of, as well as this being like the start of the kind of plan free years, it was a bit like every album's the last now, you know, that kind of thing. Not in a kind of doom laden way, just like, you know, surely we've only got one more in us, you know. It was a bit like that. And so there was an element of like, can we just leave the place as we found it, tidy up, get all these ideas that were still kind of pulling at our for our attention, you know. And we kind of had a little bit of an unspoken thing where we were just kind of cleaning everything up and let's make these recordings as good as we can. And sure enough, you know, as soon as you start that, you know, things are out of your control pretty quickly and you're starting to kind of write other things. And so the sort of sunshine started to come back a bit, really.
And it's funny because I think, you know, there is a kind of, and we've spoken about this with other guys as well, there is a kind of freedom about it. And I wonder if there's a, if that, you know, you lost your record deal, all those kind of financial difficulties as well, that there's a freedom that comes with that because you no longer, in a way, you no longer have to sort of care about having a hit or, you know. Did that have a sort of other impact on you?
Yeah, we definitely had an element of it kind of being a bit of an ill-fitting suit, really, the whole, when we were in the record company, there was a little bit of distance between us, naturally. We were up in Kilmarnock and they were in London, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like nowadays, really. We were up and down in the sleeper a lot, but it never really kind of sat that well with us, not with me especially, you know. I never really felt comfortable, and we were always kind of struggling to find a kind of naturalness, you know, And I think maybe as people, you know, with good intentions are trying to help you and they're trying to kind of suggest things that might, you know, might make their job a bit easier, for instance. But without really noticing it, I think our confidence kind of got chipped away a little bit at a time, and a bit like the boiling of the frogs, you know, we don't really notice it. And then you just, I can remember kind of feeling a little bit like I didn't know really what I wanted to do, what kind of songs we were going to be doing, or if any, you know, which was kind of, I suppose, why there was a bit of a refuge in the, right, we've got this half a dozen songs here that we quite like, let's just kind of finish them up, make a mini album or something. So there was a little bit of, you know, comfort in that. And yeah, so it was definitely a case of kind of, we had a lot of trepidation about kind of doing things ourselves, but kind of for once kind of timing worked out for us, you know, with the sort of internet just kind of burgeoning at that time. So we found a way through it, you know, with a little help from friends.
What were those first kind of half a dozen songs, Frank, that you can remember came up? What were the sort of first marks on the paper?
Yeah, I was trying to remember last night. We had Trouble Sleeping was very early song that John had written about and still unsolved murder in Bertrew Hill, where I grew up and where Paul grew up. So we had that, and I think we had recorded that in Shabby Road right towards the end, you know, when we still, before the Pigeons had sort of taken over. And I think Campbell Owens played bass on that, I remember, last night, which kind of completely slipped my memory. I don't know, not that Campbell has, but just that he was still on there, you know, because things went through a few different, you know, brought into different studios and tapes were imported from here to there. But yeah, Campbell's actually still playing. It's his performance on that, and he was really fabulous. Yeah.
Well, he is.
So that was one.
So you had Trouble Sleeping, that was an early one. Other early things that were coming up, Frank?
Let me think. Leave Us Alone became Leave Me Alone. Leave Us Alone, I think we'd written as a kind of like, you know, close the doors and, you know, make the world go away kind of thing, you know, Jim Reeves number. We had that. Usually, I think, was there. A kind of lot of long, sprawling, slow songs, you know. There was definitely a mood in the air, kind of somberness kind of hanging over us. And
Paul talked about you recording those in Dartford. Hartford, not Dartford. Dartford, that's Dartford, in London.
Yeah, no, it was the insurance capital of the world in Connecticut. Oh, it was, yeah, we went up to the old Colt factory, I'm sure he told you, which was a bizarre old broken down factory, dusty and desolate. And it was the old Samuel Colt factory where the munitions had been made mostly for the Russian army, actually, by the end of the war. So it had a giant minaret atop of it, which the Russians had given the Colt family as a thank you for their help during the war. So if you can imagine this, I don't know if you've seen that Simpsons with the box factory. So we've got this old, like, run-down, smashed windows, your worst secondary school 70s nightmare, kind of run-down with dust and on top of it was this gleaming, like, electric blue, brown, starred minaret towering over it. So when we arrived, we were like, what is this place, you know? And we were stuck away in the sixth floor, and it was empty, and it was creepy, and the area was really dodgy. You know, we were kind of advised to stay in, so we did. And not surprisingly, I think, you know, the half a dozen songs that we took over there ended up, you know, we didn't really feel like we wanted to kind of stand behind them as records. You know, everything was really slow. I mean, we were pretty stoned, actually, the whole time. We were unhappy with it by the end of it anyway, at the end of our 3 weeks there. But we did come out with Weightlifting, which was the backing track that we eventually used for the song. So
Yeah, and we'll maybe come back to that particular thing, because I'm going to, there's a bunch of songs that I'd like to get, you know, individual comment on, and there's a bone of contention has arisen over weightlifting, which I'll tell you about. But one thing, I'll come back to it, because I don't want to confuse you too early in the conversation. What strikes me about that, because Paul described this beautifully as well, in a sense, is the way that sort of bands work together and work their way through, you know, their lives through music. And mm-hmm. hearing you talk about that long process of collaboration, it does sort of strike to the heart of the collaborative nature of the Trash Can Sinatras. And I was interested, yeah. from your perspective, how that collaboration works, both in a writing sense, but also in terms of how you make music together, how you sculpt music together. So maybe talk through that process, and with specific reference to this album.
I think we all enjoy the collaborative process. I don't know if it's a lack of, you know, just the ego kind of being a little suppressed in one area, where we do enjoy this kind of here's my song, can you make it better kind of thing. And to varying degrees we have it. I think I'm probably, because I think I'm the worst of the songwriters, I enjoy the collaboration. You know, I don't really enjoy kind of sitting with my own ideas. I've always liked to have Paul and John and Davey and Stephen kind of contribute to them, you know. It's always made me happier, you know, and those are my favourite Trash Can songs in our catalogue, you know, the ones that were, I remember the kind of collaborative moment, you know, where we kind of clicked together and our ideas kind of married up, you know. And so we've always, I think me being the most like that, though we've always kind of happy to feed our ideas into this trough, you know. I always describe it as a kind of pig's trough that we're just kind of bucketing like ideas into, and everybody's aware and has access to the trough. You know, I keep kind of ideas in my head that are very, very like 20 years old, you know, that we really should get round to that idea of Paul's, you know, that was really good. So we always have a kind of store, you know, of stuff to work on and adding to it all the time, you know. And I think we are richer for it, you know. We've also done singular songs and just moved ahead with them, and I've never really quite got as much satisfaction out of that.
Those ones, where are those big collaborative moments, you think, on weightlifting as an album? What are the songs that most exemplify that?
The ones where me, John and Paul were kind of sitting together with our acoustic guitars and hitting on the right chord to suggest to somebody else, like, that could be a chorus. Got Carried Away was very much like that. We had a basic idea. Paul had done a little four-track cassette tape of this song and had a great verse. But we didn't really know where to take it. He'd moved around in keys, and it was... I always kind of look at that kind of wearily, think, I'll never be able to sing this at the end, you know, whatever we come up with. So we'd sat around, the three of us, and I think John came up with some chords for a chorus. And we were just really singing around, just like we always did, like back when we first started. So Got Carried Away as though in All the Dark Horses are the two songs that really spring to mind, and Weightlifting too, in a more convoluted way, in that John had come up with an idea that he was kind of married to for a while, and we took him a while, it took us a while to get him to kind of admit it wasn't good enough.
Yeah, John spoke a lot about that sort of process between you guys, but and he also spoke about, just to keep on Got Carried Away for a minute, about the sense of that song being a song that you guys kind of shared as a message to each other. I don't know if that's something that you recognise. Certainly, it's got that. Yeah, there's a kind of family thing about it.
Yeah, it's a song about forgiveness, and amongst, you know, we were really special to each other without really admitting it to ourselves, you know, either to each other, to ourselves. And I think when John and Edna, my big sister, kind of got together, and a sort of more traditional kind of family element to the band kind of started, Stephen being John's brother, and kind of made things official, really, like, you know, we'd consummated the whole thing, and I don't know, we'd really kind of started to accept each other. We'd kind of fought a little bit against it through the trying times, you know. You kind of look at each other and maybe look for somewhere to hang your troubles, you know, something to blame things on. And we kind of came, that song was kind of typical of the kind of feeling around at the time, that, hey, you know, this is, we still enjoy being together, we still are fans of each other's work, and, you know, let's so that song kind of came up as reflecting on that, you know.
I suppose a more exuberant sort of version of that is the other one that you mentioned there, All the Dark Horses, you know, which is just kind of so up on its toes, it's unbelievable. It's just so good. that's another one where I think, you know, again, for me as an outsider looking into your group, I'm seeing all of those kind of the ideas that are pouring into Trash Can Sinatra's music are so present in that track. It's ram full of creative ideas.
There's not a lot on it, really. But what's happening is very kind of bubbly and involved. You know, Paul's guitars are really, he's really tweaked up to 11. You know, he's really kind of fiddling away like crazy. Stephen's really bouncing along, and it was really rambunctious, the whole thing, you know. But we always enjoyed, like, you know, I always love hearing our own instrumental. It's my preferred way to listen to Trash Can music. And that way I can kind of hear all the ideas that we just, you know, we'd sweat over, as a lot of people do, you know. We'd sweat over, like, the minutest detail that you'd never hear in a million years, you know. So we've always had that attention to detail there.
Paul Livingston said, busy guitars with no room for the vocal and then a quiet vocal.
That's right.
We
were always in the studio turning each other down, you know, like faders, like, no, I need to be lower.
Yeah, but they, I suppose, you know, what I think is beautiful about that and that song, it benefits from that kind of, you know, rambunctious, as you say it, sort of, you know, energy about it, and it's a beautiful thing. And that, again, the sort of harmonic sophistication, the really great chord ideas towards the end, mm-hmm. when you get Paul's solo that does that beautiful key change.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm still learning some of these things too. I think he said recently that that came about because he accidentally turned the pitch wheel of his Porter studio, and he just at that moment realize, oh, that's what the song needs to do. It needs to somehow get up a semitone, you know. We always, you know, Paul's great at just the sneakiest, most graceful kind of key changes in his music, you know. And that was another one.
The other interviews I've done with the other two guys, we spoke a lot about you as a singer, and I'll come back to that with you a wee bit later. But the sound of the band you're talking about there and those backing tracks, there's a beautiful kind of texture there that comes from those different musicians and not just Paul and John and what they're doing on the guitars, but the other guys as well. But mm-hmm. maybe unpick that a wee bit more for us in terms of how it worked on weightlifting, because there are tracks that have got this dense arrangement, then other things where there's all of that kind of space, and the two guitars at the heart of that are such a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, they're Paul and John's kind of Ronnie Wood, Keith Richards kind of thing is basically the band, really. That's me and Stephen kind of fit in that, and Davey too, but they're really kind of what everything hangs around for the most part. And each song, and then this would have been the same for Weightlifting, would have been taken as an individual work. We'd work on that, and we just, with really no mind to anything else at that time anyway, on that album, we just kind of individually pick our moments and the songs that we needed to be enhanced. You know, you just kind of feel that pull of, like, there's a beautiful moment in there, and one of us needs to step in and kind of make it happen, whether it be the singing or maybe, you know, would suggest a kind of higher register guitar or another instrument. So we just kind of focus really kind of moment by moment, song by song, and try and make it as... There was a drive in us, you know, just to kind of partly kind of, you know, it got us into trouble sometimes. We'd overdo things, but we were still learning. We still are learning, you know, just to kind of not have so much in there all the time. And
Andy Chase talked a wee bit about taking stuff away. You know, we're talking to him about mixing the record, and you know, he was saying that he actually felt empowered to sometimes take lines of vocals away or whatever to create a bit of space. Let's talk about the production of the album a wee bit. We'll come back to the songs. Andy obviously mixed it. Just maybe talk about the impact he made on the final record.
I think we needed somebody. This was a learning period for us too. We'd been in Shabby Road and had all the luxury to mix and remix and re-record. And our last album that we made there was Happy Pocket. And we're really exhausted after it. I was really kind of exhausted after it. We just packed a lot into that record, you know, and we did a lot of work on it. And at the same time, you know, it ended up being a really dense record because there was nobody there to kind of say, you know, you can't, this at all doesn't fit, you know. It was busting at the seams, and I still quite like the sound of it now. It's a kind of like, It's kind of jangly without having any of the kind of normal kind of jangle effects. It's very suffocated, like somebody's threw a quilt over a guy with a Rickenbacker. So I think after that we were still learning, like, right, we need to give this to somebody, and then if we're going to give them the money to do it, we should let them do it, you know. And so it was mostly kind of come from like letting go of control, because we'd kind of formed in the studio, so we all were quite comfortable, especially me kind of with my finger on the buttons, you know. And Edna used to come in and watch us recording, and she'd say if I was doing the engineering part, you know, I'd have my finger on the talk back button while they were recording, ready to stop them, you know. So it was getting to the point where it was like pushing buttons for pushing buttons' sake, you know, like we were just in that mode of recording. So Andy was really important as somebody who, you know, we'd had producers before and had been successful with them, you know, had great time with Ray Showman and for our second album, for instance. But this was somebody that we'd had to sort of hire, find ourselves and just sort of pray for the best, you know. And definitely a clarity is what he brought to it, you know. I don't remember him bringing any lyrics or song lines out. I do remember him chopping out bits of music, but it basically just needed focus. That's what we've kind of lacked. We're quite an idiosyncratic bunch, I think, and we kind of write in kind of different styles, and the influences that we all have are all feeding into everything that we're doing, and so it can sometimes be a bit of a mess, really, you know. And we really needed somebody to do that job that a good producer does, that, you know, takes control.
Let's talk a wee bit more about some of the songs. Weightlifting, obviously, is one that's a big highlight, and it's become a well-loved Trash Can song. And so Andy Chase says that he got a Weightlifting and sped it up like 6-7 mm-hmm. beats a minute. And Duncan Cameron says, no, that never happened. So it's maybe one that we're never going to get to the bottom of.
No, I think I'm pretty sure it was sped up. I'm pretty sure Andy sped up. In fact, I seem to remember the technology at the time. We couldn't speed it. We wanted to speed it up a tiny bit more than we actually did. That's my memory of it. But I'm sorry, Duncan. I think Andy's right. I think we did speed it up. In fact, I know he did, because I was doing these, I've mentioned these session breakdowns, and I had the tapes out. And the vocals are faster than the... It's all digitized now. It was originally recorded on tape. So what we must have done is, you know, manually, analog way, with the tape machine, we must have just sped it up for me to sing what has become the kind of new speed, you know. Uh-huh. So on the digital ones, the singing's actually faster than the faster than the backing track, which had been recorded in Connecticut. So there you go, so the proof's
you,
there.
You have solved it, right? That is very
I
good.
I think and, so, yeah.
And you can bet your bottom dollar that this conflict will be preserved in this edition of Classic Scottish Albums. So it's a great story, but the song itself is, again, it's one of those, it's just a, such a beautiful thing, but it's so simple. What was your entry point to that song?
It started with another song called Weightlifting that Paul had kind of got together, mostly written, and I'd helped him with it a wee bit and added a bit of music. And one of the lines in this song was, you'll find a great weightlifting. I think he'd written, he'd been to a tarot card reader or something on the beach. I might be getting him mixed up with Carry On at Your Convenience here, but I seem to remember him saying that he went to, I seem to remember he was on a beach, Brighton or something, and he went to a tarot card reader, and this song were some of the things that had been told, including You'll Find a Great Weightlifting. And so this song was recorded, and didn't see the light of day, but it turned out pretty good. And then through this period where nothing much was happening, John kind of popped up and said, oh, remember that line? I wrote this chorus for it. I put it in this song, which was basically weightlifting as we know and love it, really. But then we had to kind of figure out some lyrics for the verse and I think a feel for it too. Again, it was slightly kind of too ploddy for me. And we sped it up and I had immediately kind of thought about Dreams by Fleetwood Mac. It gave me that kind of feel, you know. So I kind of listened a lot to Dreams and kind of tried to hear how the phrasing kind of worked, you know, like what Stevie Nicks was kind of, how she was kind of structuring her lines, you know, like oddly, you know, compared to how I would do it, very different. So I started to look for melodies that would kind of give me that same kind of feeling, you know. And then we fit some words around it I'm not too sure where they all came from.
But I understand that feeling of sometimes not knowing exactly where the words come from. But there is a kind of, there's a sort of people-y thing about the song Weightlifting. Similarly to Got Carried Away, there's a sort of sense that you're speaking to people and there's a kind of empathy about the song.
Oh yeah, I mean that's always, I think that we're always trying to do that. We're always trying to, you know, speak to people in that way. You know, like without trying to be trite, it's pretty hard. It's pretty hard to do. You know, I think I'd the flatmate that I had at the time, she'd just come out of a long relationship, and she was in that kind of funk that you get into in those times where you just don't want to do anything. You know. I remember that kind of fed into what I was trying to kind of contribute to it, because me and John, I think, kind of put those verse lyrics together. So, you know, I remember that was part of it. So, yeah, we're always kind of looking out at the people around us or ourselves and kind of trying to kind of G each other up a little bit, you know.
Another song that we've spoken about with the other guys is Free Time. And maybe one of the songs that could be, you might disagree, almost on any Trash Can Sinatra's record, it's almost got that kind of, it's got you, if it was a stick of rock, it would have Trash Can Sinatra's written all the way through it.
Right, great idea, actually, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good merchandise idea, actually.
We'll add it to the list with the wallpaper and all that stuff.
The underpants.
Yeah.
So Free Time, but it does have that kind of, it's got that playful thing, not just in that lyrical thing that you sometimes do, these beautiful sort of wordplay ideas and this kind of tumbling around, but there's a kind of lightness about it as well.
Yeah, it was an important song because it was kind of like, I mentioned these recordings that we had in Connecticut, and then as we were trying to pull ourselves together again, there was a lot of long, slow songs, you know, that were great in themselves. But I think Free Time and Maybe It's a Miracle were the first kind of couple of things that we had that were perky, and it really kind of energized us, you know, just disproportionately. We were like, yeah, like a great, a wee fast song, let's do that one now. Because that was, they were kind of thin in the ground at the time, you know. So it was probably a manifestation of us, you know, coming together and feeling a little freer. And it was a song to have fun with, you know, like, what is that? Like the Blue Skies, However Fleeting, and things like that. Some of those lyrics just kind of came to me. I was helping out Paul, who had the main idea from a trip to Arran, and I was just adding like kind of fun lines for me, killing our time, watching us die, all that stuff. I love to have fun like that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously such a thing that you do and do so beautifully, and again, it sort of characterises in a way Trashcan Sinatra's music. But I suppose one of the other things is that soulful kind of thing that really comes out so strongly on Weightlift. And I mean, one of the songs you mentioned earlier was Usually, and mm-hmm. again, a beautiful Paul Livingston idea, that guitar. I know that John was a big writer on that, but that beautiful guitar figure as well. Talk to us about that song.
That one, the
kind of ascending guitar figure at the start.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of John's song, that one. You'd really need to kind of talk to him. I helped him out a little bit with it. Yeah, but we all knew what he was singing about. We instantly kind of got what he was doing. You know, we'd all been in those charity shops. We'd all seen the scene in there, you know. And John's just so beautiful. Like you say, soulful. John and both John and Paul are really beautiful, soulful writers, you know. And they get to the heart of an issue like that, you know, like grief in their own kind of way, which always kind of, and I really admire them for it, you know. I'm kind of hanging on for dear life with them, you know.
Frank, talk to me a wee bit about your vocals in this record, and you know, it's, I think you're such a great singer and a great sound and such a natural beauty in the way that you sing and your tone. Do you think you had changed as a singer by the time you got to this record?
I think it sort of it may have kind of like triggered a change. I don't remember at the time feeling that I was trying anything different, but I was kind of struggling really kind of with identity. I wasn't writing that much. I was kind of more helping out at the beginning with other people's songs and adding things. So I was a little bit kind of low in confidence, really. But again, I think a group like us is the only way I could have ever have thrived, you know, and been able to sing and have a kind of life doing it, you know, because I had like two guys and both, I had four guys around me who were always kind of helping each other, you know, and they really kind of boosted me. I'm not a big fan of my own voice. I don't really like hearing it, you know. I find it I've got a tricky relationship with it, you know. I know you sing too, so I'm sure you feel this too, but it's just getting it to
I don't sound like you, Frank. I know what you're saying, and it is as a singer, I think you know, you do have that feeling of, oh my God, I'm never going to make this. The sound that comes out of my mouth is never going to match the connection I have with the cosmos. You know what I mean? And I do understand that, yeah. but I suppose for you. You know, you. I think you're known as a singer, and I think mm-hmm. you're known as somebody who's got a certain voice. So it's interesting to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, I'd like to. I think I've got a lot better recently. I've always been really shy about singing, and I've found it difficult to be on stage. I'm very, very nervous about doing it in front of people, and it's been a bit of a constant struggle for me, really, to be honest, because I just don't like the sound of it. I just listen back and I think I could have done that so much better. I should have done it in a different key. Listening to this was for this program was it wasn't completely angst free, you know. I didn't really enjoy it that much. I think that's why I really love the instrumentals. I can relax and sort of listen to the fun that we had really before the work started for me.
Ah, well, that's...
Yeah. I know, but we all think that, right? All singers don't really like their voices, isn't that true?
Yeah, I think it probably is true, but yeah. You sing great.
I'm so glad that people like it. You know, people. When I get compliments, I'm like inordinately grateful for it. You know, they don't know how much they're helping me.
Ah, that's great, Frank. Look, I've got one last question, okay, which is a bit of a broad one, and you know, it might not land with you, but obviously we're calling this a classic Scottish album, which it is. But I think there's that notion of what being a Scottish band. Is that something do you feel that Trash Can Senators are a Scottish band, if that's a thing? And if so, where do you think you fit in the sort of history of Scottish music or the world of Scottish music?
Definitely on the outside a little bit. I think that's... you can really just picture Glasgow and then you can picture Kilmarnock, and that's kind of how it feels. It feels like we're Kilmarnock, you know, and it feels like we're Irvine, and Glasgow felt like a step up for us, you know, just in terms of when we were getting together. I was actually just listening to an interview with Andrew O'Hagan last night, you know, for his new book, Mayflies, which is... Andrew grew up in, I think, Kilwinnan, but he hung out in Irvine around the same pubs that I did and we did. I knew him to look at and his crowd. But his new book is all about that time. I'm really looking forward to reading, you know, like somebody as skilled as him kind of, you know, putting it into a story. But it was definitely a real scene in Irvine at the time, and there was like countless bands and incredibly talented people who, for whatever reason or not, didn't have the same kind of ratio of drive and talent, you know, like some people were just like through the roof, but they just couldn't get it together, you know, or wanted to do something else. And but there was just so many, and we just kind of, for one reason or another, stuck it out, and I suppose got a record deal, got lucky that way, and carried on. But it was definitely a scene, and all we were focused on was that scene, and like not being sneered at within that scene, really. And being cheered, so we went from that, and then we thought, well, let's go to Ardrossan and play a gig in Ardrossan or New Cumnock and try that, and then eventually we'd get to Glasgow. So we always felt a little bit like we were, you know, like coming from the outside, you know. Then of course you had the whole London thing, so. But yeah, we definitely feel like I still feel like we're that band, you know, that Irvine band. Definitely. A West Coast kind of harmony band, you know, like a lot of West Coast bands. I always think Scotland in terms of like the East Coast is where the kind of more angular stuff is, and maybe the cold north wind does that, north sea wind, and the West Coast is where all the country looking to the west, you know, the country harmonies and all that.
Yeah, and despite what you've said about the vocals, how do you think Weightlifting stands up?
Well, I was listening to it last night, and apart from the vocals, it's great. It's just brilliant. I really love it. I'm just really glad people like it and got a lot out of it. And I accept that we succeeded in what we were doing, because what we were trying to get across is what people are now reflecting back at us and saying, you know, that's how it made me feel. And I think, oh, good, good, good. We did get that across, however convoluted and however mysterious and misty time has made it worked, you know.
Frank, thank you so much. It's a fantastic record, and yeah, I love your music.
Oh, thanks a lot, dude. I really enjoyed talking to you. It's good to get a wee shot of home.
My thanks to John Douglas, Frank Reader, and Paul Livingston. Thanks to you for listening to Classic Scottish Albums. The podcast is available on BBC Sounds or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you like what you've heard, please do leave us a rating and review.
Subscribe to this show on BBC Sounds and don't miss the next episode.